Morning, everybody. Looks like we have a quorum, and we got some bills we want to address here.
Oh, there we go.
Let's go ahead and get started. And we have some minutes. Representative Fisher, you want to?
I'll move the minutes, please.
Representative Fisher moves approval of the minutes for March 19, 2014. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Representative Russo, I want to step forward and present your bill, please.
There it is. Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee.
Good morning. The chair will move that House File 2324 be referred to the General Register. Go ahead and.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The bill is to add three types of classroom professionals to the teachers' bargaining unit under PELRA. It is art therapists, music therapists, and audiologists. Previously, physical therapists and occupational therapists have been similarly added. Art therapists, music therapists, and audiologists have become increasingly important in helping special education students succeed. They've earned four-year degrees and are subject to most of the same requirements as teachers in the classrooms. They tend to be in very small numbers in districts or in individual schools, and so they wouldn't really be capable of forming their own bargaining unit. And considering that the other therapists have been added to the teachers' unit, that seems to make the most sense for them. And that's all there is to it.
Very good. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against? Welcome. Want to identify yourself and go ahead?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Thorson with Education Minnesota. And this bill, as Representative Russo mentioned, simply tries to take three types of employees in school districts, art therapists, music therapists, and audiologists. And statewide, there may be 70 or so of these folks that work for school districts. So I think any particular school district probably wouldn't have more than two or three of them. And many school districts don't have any at all on the payroll. There are service cooperatives dealing with special ed services that may employ some of these folks. And in fact, there was a service cooperative. Education Minnesota received a letter from Darren Kermes, Executive Director of the Minnesota River Valley Special Ed Cooperative, when they merged with the Carver-Scott Education Cooperative. They employed these therapists and audiologists and had assumed they were in a teacher's bargaining unit. It became a complication in their merger, and they too are seeking to make this change. The precedent for this is occupational therapists and physical therapists have also been added to the definition of teachers solely for the purposes of bargaining in the past. They're also professionals working in special education, which has become a much more intensive and specialized service provided by schools.
Very good. Thank you for the testimony. Members, questions? Representative Driscoll?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Russo, my assumption is that there's, and the folks from Education Minnesota may be able to help us out with this too, just some background. My assumption is that because of the nature of these services, and it was just testified that some districts can't or maybe don't have the need to employ someone full-time, the idea would be that there'd also be a host district, and these may be services that are shared outside of a cooperative in greater Minnesota as well, that there may be a host district, and then there's a joint powers agreement to reimburse the district for those services. Which, how would that affect, I think I know the answer, I'm just going to ask the question, how does that affect collective bargaining for those individuals when they, in their districts, when they are permitted to join a local?
Mr. Thorson?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, this would apply to folks, again, because there's not, in and of themselves, they're not a community of interest. So if they're employed in an entity that has a bargaining relationship with teachers, this would simply add them to that unit. It wouldn't create a bargaining relationship if there wasn't one already. So as I said, with occupational therapists, physical therapists, these individuals, let's say there is a school district that is making arrangements to provide for very specialized service in special ed, and may have one, two, three of these individuals employed in that school district. Those individuals would be added to the teacher's bargaining unit for the purposes of being able to engage with the employer. It doesn't create a bargaining relationship that doesn't already exist.
Mr. Andrisco?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pursuing that just a little bit then, would these individuals then be placed on a separate pay scale if they become a member of a bargaining unit because of the nature of what they do, versus generally my experience has been that if you're a K through 12 teacher, regardless whether you teach science, physical education, music, art, kindergarten teacher, everybody starts out at 0-0, moves over on the scale for years of service, and then how many credits you've obtained past your bachelor's or into a master's plus. Would these folks be on the same scale, or would there be a separate scale included in the collective bargaining agreement from your background and experience?
Mr. Carson?
Sure. And Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, I presume that would be determined between the employer and the this employee. Again, this does not make them licensed teachers. These individuals, by dint of being added to the bargaining unit, aren't they don't become licensed or treated differently from the Board of Teaching. They would have an opportunity to interact with the employer about needs specific to the work they provide in the district.
Thank you. Okay, very good. Rex, you go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Representative Urusso, do you have any testifiers this morning from these occupations, with any of the therapists? Do we have anybody representing that group?
Rex, Urusso?
Mr. Chair, no, I do not.
Mr. Chair, well, the reason I ask is, of course, I represent the largest school district in the state of Minnesota, the Anoka-Hennepin District. I haven't had a single email on this. Nobody has contacted me with regard to joining the union or setting this up whatsoever. I'm just concerned about these people and their voice here. Perhaps they don't want to do this. Do you have a comment on that?
Representative Urusso?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Uglum, my comment on that would be that in my experience, people have no trouble whatsoever finding you when they have a complaint about something. And so I would take the silence as an indication that there is at least not some huge outcry against it.
Representative Uglum?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I guess I just have some reservations about this whole thing. The largest school district in the state can't contact their representatives, so thank you.
Representative Benson?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My questions, I guess, are along the same line in terms of the 70 that are in the state. So maybe there's one or two that have two or three. I doubt that. But how many of the districts Ed Minnesota bother contacting these individuals and telling them that here's a bill that we require? I see this honestly as there's no cry to become part of the bargaining unit. It's just another attempt by Ed Minnesota to grab another 70 people to either have them paying in dues or fair share. Not a real need for these people to become part of a bargaining unit. My assumption is that many of these folks may not even be full-time, but yet we're going to push them in this direction. So my question is, did anybody bother to notify these 70 about the bill and that they would be required to become part of the bargaining unit and end up paying dues and fair share?
Ms. Thorson or Representative Uglum, or Representative Urusso, I'm sorry.
Sure. Excuse me, Mr. Chair, Representative Benson. This is an issue that was discussed last legislative session. and attempt to be part of the omnibus education bill. So there was a discussion of this last session. This is the third hearing. This is received twice in the other body. There's been no opposition to the bill. There's been discussions with the School Board Association, no one has opposed this bill when given an opportunity. I guess, again, I'd point to the communication from an employer, the executive director of the merged cooperative, and he states that through the course of merging two service cooperatives that provide this service, they discovered some of their job classifications under current state law are not eligible to be included in a bargaining unit that represents teachers. The discovery led to confusion and consternation on the part of our staff and administration alike. goes on to speak about the service, and we'd always believed our music therapist was a licensed professional educator who could be represented by the teachers unit. Unfortunately, we discovered this was not the case for both our music therapist and other professionals in the classroom. This is a letter from an employer that seeks to make this clarification and adjustment.
Yeah, we'll follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You should run for office. You didn't answer my question. I heard all that, but what I didn't hear is that at no time has anybody contacted the 70 to say, "Hey, we're going to create a bill that will require you to be part of that." I guess maybe the other part of that would be if I needed this service, if I was a school district and didn't want to add another one or two or three people to the bargaining unit, I might be inclined to sever my relationship with one of those 70 and say, I'm going to contract it, and I'll show it on the books as a contracted position rather than employee, if that's possible. But I don't really see the need for this at all, and really just see this as an opportunity for Ed Minnesota to pick up 70 more dues-paying people. I'll just leave it at that.
Representative O'Driscoll?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Urusso, were you ever approached by the art therapists to carry this bill?
Representative Urusso?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative O'Driscoll, no, I was asked to carry the bill.
Representative Urusso, were you ever approached, thank you, Mr. Chair, by the music therapists to carry this bill?
Representative Russo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I was asked to carry the bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Russo. The third one on the list that's being considered here, the audiologist. Have you been approached by the audiologist to carry this bill?
Representative Russo.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative Driscoll, no, I was asked to carry the bill.
Representative Russo. Who asked you to carry the bill if it wasn't the people who were being covered?
Representative Russo.
Education Minnesota.
Okay.
Mr. Chair,
excuse me, Mr. Chair,
Representative Urusso,
of which I have proudly been a member in the past.
I'm just trying to figure out, Mr. Chair, who asked to carry the bill. It appears that none of the people who are covered in here had approached. And in the letter that was referred to by Education Minnesota today, it sounded like it was a response to an inquiry from the newly merged co-op, where they've said they don't seem to have a problem with this. And so it looks like they were approaching and said, hey, we would like to do this. Do you have any questions or issues with this? Your comment before about, silence sometimes is fine. Do these folks even know that this is being proposed in the legislature?
Representative Urusso?
Mr. Thorson.
Mr. Thorson?
If I may, Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, the genesis of this issue was Education Minnesota being contacted by these individuals last year to seek inclusion in the bargaining unit. The letter I referenced, and I wasn't intending to speak to this letter so much today, I'm happy to make a copy of it and get it to members of the committee, response at near the end of session last year from an employer encouraging the work that was being done by these individuals and Education Minnesota to include them in a bargaining unit. There is another committee stop for this bill. I'm very pleased to find the individuals we were working with last year to attend the next committee hearing and speak to this one.
Mr. Chair.
Representative
Driscoll. this is going to go to the Ed Policy Committee before it goes to the General Register?
Nope.
So we're having a bill that deals with education and training and teachers in the classroom and students, but it's not going to see our Education Policy Committee in the House. It did in the Senate, I understand, but it's not going to in the House. Is that correct?
I understand, Representative O'Driscoll, it's a labor matter that this committee has purview over. Representative Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a process to find out if people want to join a union. Is anybody, shouldn't we have a vote of these folks to find out whether or not they're indeed wanting to be part of the union? I mean, if all this time Ed Minnesota has not been able to organize these folks, there's got to be some reason. Maybe it's just the few number, and this is it's not really emerging because many of these, if not most, have been around for 20, 30 years at least. But isn't there a process with the Labor Relations Board that maybe, you know, we need to at least consider in terms of bringing these people into the union without their consent? That's to the testifiers.
Representative Thorson, briefly.
Mr. Thorson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson. An individual or two individuals within a school district is not a community of interest in and of itself. These are individuals that are seeking to join the community of interest of teachers solely for the purposes of bargaining, and that's what this bill is attempting to do.
Last.
Mr. Chair, if I might, if these folks want to be unionized, I personally don't have a problem with that. The thing I find just amazing is that we never heard from these folks. There isn't a letter from these individuals. There isn't anything that's happened. And that we're not taking this and bringing it to education policy. Yes, it's a labor issue, but it's also an education issue with policy. And I really think that we're stubbing our toe on the processes and procedures in the House if we don't bring it to the Education Committee. And if it's going to go to the General Register, I suppose we could do this in one of two ways. I could bring it up on the floor and ask for the body to consider following this, or I could appeal to the chair and ask if the chair would be willing to bring this to the education policy. I just think it's an important consideration. And again, if they want to be involved, I'm fine. I just think that we haven't had a chance to hear that would give these individuals a chance to come at least before another committee in the House to have some input and to help us as a body to understand that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Representative Kiefer, last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. More of just a comment. I'm thinking back last year, the daycare unionization bill, and there were thousands of letters saying, please don't do this to us. We don't want it. We've got 70 people here we're talking about. I bet most of them don't even know this is happening. And I just hate to see our government keep clawing in on the little guy because they're busy working and aren't paying really a lot of attention to what's happening here at the Capitol. I would really like to see you reach out to some of these people and at least show us a letter in support from these people with their signature on it or something, because I'm tired of do-overs here too. That unionization bill for the daycare providers is put on hold now, and we voiced our concerns about it in this committee last spring. So I just would really ask the author to consider taking this a little slower, making sure we've got all the stakeholders' voices taken into consideration, please. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Last comment, Representative Urso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, the bill is scheduled to go before another committee, so there's the opportunity for that. And it is not, I've spoken to the chair of K-12 education policy, and as it does not affect the instructional methods or the relationships between these people and the students, and there's the previous precedent of adding the other sorts of therapists, it does not need to go before the Education Policy Committee. So that has been discussed with that chair and cleared with him. Thank you for your consideration. And as I said, it's going to government operations, I believe. Is that the motion? No?
The motion,
excuse me, I'm sorry. I'm confusing two of my bills. But we would certainly await comments from people that, as if they have any objections to it going forward. I appreciate your support.
Very good. The chair renews his motion that House File 2324 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. You're on your way. Thank you for your testimony. I saw Representative Anzell here. The chair moves that House File 2939 be re-referred to the General Register. And you have a DE1 amendment, is that correct?
That's correct.
Is that your
chair.
Amendment?
That's my amendment.
And you'd like that placed on. I'm going to move that amendment. Members, any discussion to that amendment? Hearing none, all those in discussion to the amendment? No.
Mr. Chair, this is related to the last bill. You said it's going to the General Register, but the author of the bill said it's going to another committee, and I would just like some clarification, please.
The author said that she was mistaken and she had confused it with another bill. Okay, no problem. So we're on the DE1 amendment. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have your bill with the DE1 amendment to the bill. Representative Anzell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The amendment, the DE1 amendment, puts this House file in comportment with the version that was worked out in the Senate. Members, what this bill does is to clarify what happens when joint powers authorities by local units of government are created. What happens to workers in those joint powers arrangements? The Public Employee Labor Relations Act does not clearly speak to the collective bargaining arrangement whereby workers in a number of entities become workers in a joint powers authority. Specifically, what the bill does is, in the event of the creation of a joint powers authority, it is the collective bargaining agreement that the worker previously is working under follows the worker to the joint powers authority, and when the terms and conditions of that collective bargaining agreement end, then the collective bargaining process is between the workers in the new authority and the new employer. This bill would affect cities, counties. It is in school districts, and it is frankly my attempt at saving workers and unions and employers from lawsuits where courts end up having to make judgments on various and assorted work rules and what workers' rights are. This will clarify the bargaining agreement follows the worker. When it expires, a new bargaining agreement has to be negotiated. Essentially, that's the bill.
Thank you, Representative Anzell. I know we have a couple testifiers, so I'll ask them to step forward. Is Laura Kushner here? Kushner? Welcome to the committee, and once you get situated, go ahead and identify yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. My name is Laura Kushner. I work for the League of Minnesota Cities. We represent 835 of the 854 cities in Minnesota and thousands of employees by virtue of that representation. We have been in communication with the proponents of this bill. I think it's important to know that we are very appreciative of all the efforts that they have gone to. They have gone to great lengths to make this bill more amenable to cities. We do appreciate that. Unfortunately, we have to remain opposed to this bill. Even with the amendments, it's a very big change to joint powers formations and how they happen with cities, counties, and school districts. And there are just a lot of unknowns about how it will, about the impact that it will have on those joint powers arrangements. For example, we think that the people that are forming a joint powers may look at this bill and just say, too complicated. We're not gonna wade through all of this. Let me give you an example of one of the things that I think is maybe an unintended consequence of this bill. I happen to live in the city of Mendota Heights. They provide police services for the city of Lilydale. If they were looking at a joint powers arrangement right now, once this bill passes, let's say the city of Lilydale had 3 police officers, and let's say Mendota Heights, which is much bigger, had 25 or 30. As I'm reading this bill, I'm not an attorney, but as I'm reading this bill, because it would involve Lilydale disbanding their police, their 3 officers, and contracting with Mendota Heights, those 3 officers, if they had more seniority with Lilydale than the officers at Mendota Heights, would have the ability to be bump out some of the Mendota Heights officers. So Mendota Heights would have no incentive to contract with Lilydale because some of their officers might be laid off in the process. Why would they want to do that? That would only harm their force and their existing collective bargaining agreements. I'm not sure the bill's proponents intended that to be the case, but I don't see anything in this bill that would interpret it in any other way. So we have some concerns. We think this is a big change very quickly, and we just really think it needs more careful consideration and study before this becomes law, especially in an environment where cities and counties and school districts are being so encouraged to collaborate and to work together, and we're trying to do that. I can't tell you how many cities I've talked to in the past few weeks that have said, we're in the middle of forming a joint powers. How is this going to affect us? I don't understand it. It doesn't make sense to me. Frankly, the whole thing makes me just want to forget about it. So, that's kind of what I have to say, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Good. If you'd stick around, that'd be great. Thank you for your testimony. And is there a Bo Berenson from AMC here? Welcome. If you identify yourself, and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Bo Berenson. I represent the Association of Minnesota Counties. AMC represents all 87 counties in the state. Like the representative from the League, I want to start by saying thank you. Thank you to the author. Thank you to the proponents of the bill. The amendment today, from our perspective, is considerably better than the bill as it was introduced, and we appreciate the changes that have been made. I do want to share some concerns we still have with the legislation as it stands today. This is an important issue for our organization. As a recent legislative auditor report noted, counties utilize joint power arrangements, joint power agreements, more frequently than any other unit of government in the state. And we've done that in many respects because you, the legislature, have either mandated those collaborations or at least provided important incentives for us to work together, for smaller counties to work together. I want you to think about, I'm going to speak specifically to the continuing contract provision that's in subdivision 4 of the amendment. It's the provision that the author mentioned in his testimony as well. And I wanted to kind of put it in context of a real situation that's happening in Minnesota today. There's a group of 5 counties in western Minnesota, and they're coming together to join 3 public health departments across their 5 counties. And in this process, they're protecting all employee wages, they're guaranteeing health care benefits to all the employees that will be part of the JPA, and AFSCME's been represented at the table throughout this entire process. If this bill were in law today, this new multi-county entity would face a costly administrative hurdle that could potentially undo or at least reduce the efficiencies these counties are hoping to achieve through this collaborative entity. Once the new entity is formed, this bill would require that all employees that are working for one of the member counties will remain covered by their previous collective bargaining agreement. This requirement would remain in effect until the new CBA is reached. This would put the new employer, the joint entity, in the position of having to simultaneously manage 3 separate union contracts along with a separate personnel policy for non-union employees for a relatively small group of employees largely performing the same work, same or similar work. This would require more administration, more human resources staff in order to manage these separate payroll deductions, leave accruals, and other employment policies, again, reducing or eliminating the efficiencies these local governments are trying to achieve. It also means these employees will be working side by side, potentially doing the same work, while perhaps working different work weeks, 35 hours for some, 37 for others, 40 for others, earning accrual at different rates, being paid on different wage tables, a situation that we don't think benefits employees or employers. This, under the bill, this situation of employees working in these different conditions will continue until the new collective bargaining agreement is reached. But we also have concerns that this continuing contract provision will make it more difficult for employers and employee groups to reach agreement on a CBA. When you create a situation where employees of the new entity are guaranteed different employment terms, that it will become more difficult in some cases to reach agreement on a contract that doesn't at least meet or exceed the terms of what is considered the most generous existing contract, especially if that contract isn't set to expire for several years. This continuing contract provision does not speak, as it's in the amendment, also does not speak to what happens if the employees of the new entity choose not to unionize. These continuing contract terms would then seemingly continue indefinitely or until the CBA expires, as no new collective bargaining agreement would ever be reached. I do want to point out that this continuing contract provision is similar to a requirement that was put in place when counties were authorized to create service delivery authorities several years ago. In that provision that was placed in that section of statute, there was a six-month cap on this continuing contract provision. That six-month cap is not in that bill, and we think that six-month cap was put specifically in that provision because of some of the concerns I just laid out in the testimony. I do want to make note that, speaking of that five-county entity that I mentioned at the beginning of my testimony, we raised these concerns in the hearings on this bill in the other body, and there was an amendment added that's included in the author's amendment, which we appreciate, which puts this bill into effect January 15th, 2015, meaning this entity that's been working for 3 years to collaborate will go into effect January 1st and won't fall under the requirements of this bill. But we do want the legislature to consider what will happen to the next group of counties that come together and think about working collaboratively. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify for or against?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Enzel?
There is. I want to have Sarah Leverance from Council 65 of AFSCME provide a little testimony, but certainly. I can't resist if it's all right with the chair and the members. The testimony you heard from the cities and the counties is a first for me. As the author of the bill, this is the first time that I've heard their opposition, especially their opposition to the amended version of the bill, which passed the Senate. Secondly, the service delivery joint powers exclusion goes back to the Governor Pawlenty administration, whereby Governor Pawlenty was interested in creating multi-county social service agencies. Instead of 87 county social service agencies, he was interested in creating 11 or 12. And it should not go unnoted that he included this provision in that legislation that did pass.
No, that Abler who did it.
A collective bargaining agreement should follow the worker into the new joint powers. So, Ms. Leverance is here from AFSCME Council 65.
Ms. Leverance,
thank you.
You would identify yourself, who you are, and who you represent. And go
I'm
ahead.
Sarah Leverance, and I work for AFSCME Council 65.
Welcome.
We are a local government and nonprofit union that represents employees outside of the Twin Cities area and the immediate Duluth area. In the Senate, heard the concern about the complexity of having the collective bargaining agreement follow the employee to the new joint powers authority. And since I negotiate, one of the things I've done in my life is negotiate contracts for 20 years, union contracts, I can respond in a way that I think is helpful on that. First, there's no reason that the joint powers authority members, as they're putting this together and taking their 2 or 3 years or whatever it's going to take to put them together, that they can't also be negotiating with the unions about what the collective bargaining agreement is going to be. I've negotiated lots of things ahead. The group of counties in western Minnesota has had the staff representative from our office sitting on the committee that's been putting the Joint Powers Authority together. He's been sitting on that committee for more than a year. So they know, the counties that are involved in that know they want to involve their union in resolving these issues. Second, if that's not something they want to do, if they want to wait till they're formally created, there's no reason that the employees can't continue to be paid and provided benefits by the original employer until a no agreement is reached. And finally, after having 20 years of negotiating contracts, I'd like to tell the very nice gentleman from the counties that, believe me, we see proposals when you put contracts together, and I've done it a number of times, the employer takes a position that everybody gets the lowest benefit in all the contracts, and of course we take the position that we get the highest benefits and wages in all the contracts, and we usually end up somewhere in the middle. And so I think that the complexity argument is easily resolved in either one of these ways.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony. If you want to stick around, then we'll be available for questions. That'd be great. And I think I saw one other person who wanted to testify before we get to committee comments.
Okay.
Welcome. If you identify yourself, please, and go ahead.
Yes. Good morning, Chair, members. My name is Snezhana Besanov, and I'm here on behalf of Minnesota School Boards Association. And we represent all the locally elected school board members. And I do want to join League of Minnesota Cities as well as the counties with our concerns about potential discouragement of collaboration innovation that we're encouraged to do due to complexity of the process and just the fact that it may not be able to work and they may just walk away from something that potentially could be really good. So, but thank you for bringing the amendment and your work.
Thank you, Ms. Basma, for your brief testimony. Any other comments? I don't see any. So let's open up to member questions, comments. Representative Uglin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering if we could get the representative from the counties back up here. I had a question for him.
And go ahead with your question.
All right.
Representative Uglin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, my question is, you testified that there's lots of problems with this bill in terms of the complexity, the different pay scales, the different working hours and conditions and everything else. Now, obviously, we have joint powers working right now among counties, cities, and everything else. How is that accomplished right now? It doesn't seem to be too many problems.
Go ahead and identify yourself first before you
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bill Burnson from the Association of Minnesota Counties. Thank you, Representative. You know, I think you're absolutely right. I think, you know, joint power entities are currently covered under PELRA, under the Public Employee Labor Relations Act. There's a process laid out in statute that employees and employers know the rules of the process that's set forth, what's going to govern employment conditions, and it is a system that, by and large, works very well.
Representative Uglin?
Mr. Brunstein, the other thing is you testified that this could be a restraint on the formation of joint powers. I'm concerned about the taxpayers. I really am. I mean, this is obviously a union thing, but it's also we're here because of the taxpayers. And in my mind, joint powers agreements almost always save the taxpayer money. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Expand on the issue of our joint powers typically a cost-saving result for taxpayers. You know, I think there's a lot of reasons why local governments choose to move towards joint powers. I think the issue of cost efficiency certainly is a huge part of it. But I'd also point you to examples in rural Minnesota, small counties, small cities, especially from the county perspective, where we fulfill a lot of state-mandated services. We're social service providers, public safety, corrections providers, and it's becoming more difficult to find the technical, the professional staff to fulfill those duties, each individual county working alone. So a lot of times you'll see small counties form a joint powers you know, you want to achieve some cost savings through doing things with a single administration, obviously, but also at the same time, because then you can pool a larger group of professional staff to cover a wider area when it's difficult to find those staff individual counties by individual county. Okay.
Representative Uglum?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one final comment. The city of Champlin and the city of Anoka have a joint fires board, joint powers fire board, and we set that up a long time ago. We have kind of a hybrid department. We do have some full-time guys and then we have volunteers. But we did this, didn't have any problems with that, followed PELRA and everything else. The two cities negotiated with our full-time employees, and it's probably one of the best models of joint powers fire in the metro area. It saved us tons and tons of money. Just for example, you know, a new hook and ladder fire truck will cost over $1 million. We bought one rather than two. Representative Simonson knows all of those costs by heart, no doubt. But anything that restricts the formation of joint powers, which cities and counties are working for to try and save money, I got a problem with that. And you know, I understand the position of labor and what you need and what you want, but it sure would be nice if we could come up with something that's going to work a little better. I think we need some work on this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Manziel, you want to?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the liberty you're giving me here. Representative, both the bill and Ask Me Council 65 share the goal of more effective, efficient, cost-effective local government. It's just that we don't think public money ought to be spent on lawyers arguing in court matters relating to what should be clearly spelled out in a workers' collective bargaining agreement. All the bill does is carry the collective bargaining agreement with the worker to the new entity, and then it ceases when the contract expires. And then we get into a whole different world of contract negotiations, collective bargaining, and employee-employer relationships. And lastly, as a matter of principle and philosophy, I just don't believe that only the worker should be responsible for bringing about more efficient local government.
Representative Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to seem like piling on. Some of the same questions and concerns have been expressed. I know in Olmsted County and surrounding counties in southeast Minnesota, they have an outstanding collaborative joint powers with Health and Human Services. I'm going to echo, essentially, it's working. You know, PELRA works. A tribute to the fine skills of the labor organizations and being able to negotiate, new contracts and the like, and that's part of the process of leading up to the final signing off on the joint powers agreements. And I hate to say this, but this is the second bill where it seems at least that, you know, we've got some solutions in search of a problem rather than really addressing some critical need. I understand that we're going to continue to see more and more because we need greater efficiencies. Government's got too big and it's too expensive, and we need to find ways to do that. I just think that we have found ways to do that, and they are working. And this will just overly complicate. I don't think we would have had. I'm sorry that they didn't bring these questions to you beforehand, because I've gotten emails, regarding that from my own. But I'm sorry that they didn't bring these concerns to you beforehand, so they could express them in a way to say, you know, can't we work with Ask Me and whoever to find a different way other than saying this is how you're going to do it? And I can't imagine. I mean, I've been an executive that has had to administer multiple contracts with multiple bargaining units within an organization. but they were all doing specific work within the organization. Now we're going to have overlapping contracts on work being done by the same craft, by the same people, which makes it even harder for that first-line manager or supervisor to understand many of these things. So I won't pile on anymore. Thank you.
Representative Sorensen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question will be for Mr. Burnson.
Now go ahead and ask your question as okay. You come on down.
As you're coming down, I think I heard in your testimony two things that caused me some level of concern, but did you not say that creation of a GPA oftentimes is about, or excuse me, a JPA is oftentimes about saving money between the entities? And a follow-up to that question would be, well, let's start with that question.
Mr. Burnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I was saying, I think there's multiple reasons why local governments explore joint powers. I think the effort to find efficiencies is certainly one of the driving forces, but as I mentioned in my testimony, a lot of what we're seeing, especially right now in local government, at least from the county perspective, in local governments working on these large joint power entities is more about providing the technical services in public health or social services or community corrections.
Mr. Chair.
Representative
Mr. Burnson, did you not testify that one of the reasons why entities enter into a JPA is to save money?
Mr. Chair. I think finding cost efficiencies is a driving factor, yes.
Thank you. So if we look at what we're trying to accomplish, thank you, Mr. Chair. If we look at what we're trying to accomplish in this bill, which is simply focusing in on one aspect, which is the collective bargaining agreements that's in place with the employer groups and the union prior to entering into the JPA, would you say that it's a fair assumption that at least one, if not several, counties have in the past essentially tried to ignore the collective bargaining agreement after the JPA is signed?
Mr. Burnson?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I would hesitate to say that simply because, as I mentioned before, joint power entities are covered by PELRA, and all those provisions of PELRA still apply, so there's nothing that a county could do outside of what's legal under PELRA.
Mr. Chair, and thank you, and I just want to say this, that this bill isn't going to cost any more money. In fact, what this bill will do is create savings for both the employee groups and the employer groups, because now there will be no question going forward. In the event that entities want to enter into a JPA, they will know that those collective bargaining agreements remain in place until they're negotiated with a new employer. And quite frankly, it will save money. It will save money for employers and the union groups. And to say that this is not a problem, to say that this is a solution without a problem, is untrue, because I know myself personally haven't been involved in a couple of cases where joint power agreements have been created and the employer, the new employer, has taken the position that the provisions in the CBA do not longer apply. That causes us to do one of two things, either file a grievance with the current employer or go to district court. So thank you, Representative Anzels, for bringing this forward, because this does fix a problem and it does provide some clarity going forward.
Final comment, questions, Representative Driscoll?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Anzels, I've been kind of pondering this whole thing, and I see the dilemma that you're bringing forward. I really do. And I've always tried to be a pragmatic thinker and think 360 around the circle. But one thing that continues to kind of just, as I go through that, is something that the league brought up. And I want you to maybe help the committee get a comfort level, if you could. And two is using the idea of two metro fire departments, police departments that may end up entering into a joint powers agreement. So if, just for simplicity, let's say that one of the reasons for the efficiencies is you need one police station, so you have capital outlay instead of having two police stations in a given area. You can get better efficiencies with the number of squad cars that you buy, because you're not running two squad cars in smaller areas. You're running, instead of running three in two areas, you're running two in two areas or something along that line. How would the bill save us money if there was the merging of five police officers in one community and 15 in another, and the goal was that they were going to be looking at doing some bumping and some layoffs, which the collective bargaining agreements explain how that's going to be achieved? How do you know which ones come from which contract or which joint powers agreement, collective bargaining agreement, if we're honoring both under there? So do we lay off a proportionate number in each, or that's the part I just can't get my mind around, because I think that could lead to grievances, or as Representative Simonson said, plop on us right back into to district court to have the courts figure out how that might work. And I just wondering if you could tell me how you envision that to be. That's the big thing for me right here.
Representative Anzell or Ms. Leverance, whoever you prefer.
Ms. Leverance will take a shot at that.
Representative O'Driscoll, Sarah Leverance with AFSCME Council 65. That is the one term that would normally be in a collective bargaining agreement that is actually in the bill, so the employer doesn't end up with three versions of layoff language to follow. The bill defines seniority as time with the original employer and time with the joint powers. You add those together, and then the seniority list is created that way, and that seniority applies to the layoff and recall. That way there's no doubt about if you create a joint powers agreement and the unions argue the old contracts prevail in that, how the heck would you figure out who gets laid off? I wouldn't be able to, so that's why the bill does that.
Representative Driscoll?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that does provide some help and clarification. I guess one of the other questions that I have is from the part of the state that I hail from. There are a lot of smaller communities that maybe have had, again, using the example of a police officer, where they might have hired someone who, because it's one individual, isn't able to participate in a collective bargaining agreement, and that city may choose to enter into a joint powers agreement with the county to be able to provide those services. And since they're not a part of a collective bargaining agreement, they may end up just flat out losing their job and having that joint powers agreement enter in with the county. This bill does not provide persons who are not covered by collective bargaining agreements in a joint powers agreement. Am I correct on that?
Initially,
Ms. Leverance.
The bill decides how the union will be created at the new joint powers agreement. We follow the way the language in the statute that the state used in the takeover of the court system in terms of deciding which union represented people. And at the new joint powers agreement, authority, the language would prevail in the statute, and under some of those scenarios, assuming that the larger number of people did belong to a union, that person would then become a union member, and their one person police department service would count towards their seniority. But I do need to correct you when you say that one person cannot be a collective bargaining unit, because AFSCME Council 65 represents a number of one-person collective bargaining units.
Representative Driscoll?
Well, thank you. I would use the word clarifying instead of correcting. You make it sound like
Sorry.
I was intentional. I'm just
gathering
information.
Because you didn't know.
I'm just simply gathering information in which to make a decision. Mr. Chair, I think I'd like a roll call on this vote.
Very good. Any final comments? Brief comments,
thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, and thank you for the good questions and probing comments that have been made. This bill is necessary. This is going to save both workers and local units of government legal costs. We shouldn't be spending public dollars on lawyers. We should be adhering to collective bargaining agreements.
Very good. The chair renews his motion that House File 2939, as amended, be re-referred to the General Register. Roll call being requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Johnson.
Johnson votes yes.
O'Driscoll.
No.
Benson.
No.
Fisher.
Yes.
Hoppe.
No.
Kiefer.
No.
Lane.
Yes.
Mason?
Yes.
Metza? Nelson?
Yes.
O'Neill?
No.
Savick?
Yes.
Simonson?
Yes.
Sundin?
Yes.
Uglum?
No.
The vote being 8-6, the motion prevails. The bill is passed to a re-referred, I should say, and thank you for your time, Representative Anzell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
The next bill before us is House File 2525, Representative Hansen. You want to come up? The chair will move that House File 2525 be re-referred to the General Register. Representative Hansen, you want to?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You have a DE1 amendment, is
yes,
that correct?
Yes, I do.
I'll go ahead and move that DE1 amendment to put the bill in the shape that you wish it to be in. Is there any discussion about that? Hearing none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Representative Hansen, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 2525 as amended. It seems like it's been longer than just a year that I was in front of this committee on the sick leave bill, but we've discovered since we passed that bill, I think last year with broad bipartisan support, there have been some school districts that have been redefining their employees to not meet the requirement of the bill to provide sick leave for taking parents, grandparents, etc., with leave that they have already accrued. So this bill clarifies that. The DE clarifies that it's for educational institutions, and I'd like to have your support.
We're good. Are there anybody in the audience who wishes to testify either for or against this bill? Seeing none, I'll open up to questions from committee members. Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hansen, you had referenced this in one of the other committees that you and I serve on as well, and I thought that since the bill was coming through, I would just reserve my questions. What is happening that's causing issues? I guess you're saying they're redefining, and I'll give you some background while I'm at on this. My understanding for thinking of teachers and some of the other professionals that are in there, under their contract for so many days out of the year, and then it's within kind of a school calendar that's agreed upon with a lot of folks and different things. And teachers may choose to take their pay over a 9-month period of time, over a 12-month period of time. Was there maybe some misunderstanding about that, or is there something else that I'm missing about that? And I did, for the record, vote for the bill because I thought it made some sense. I'm just looking for clarification again as to what might have happened if that was an unanticipated issue. Or
Mr. Chair, Representative Driscoll, even though teachers may have the school calendar for 9 months, they're still full-time employees. They're still, unless they're in an adjunct position or something like that, what's happening is specifically reclassifying them to be considered 9 months, so they're not able to apply under this law. There have been about a dozen districts that have in their contract negotiations say, well, this won't apply if you're 9-month employees, and we're going to reclassify you as 9-month employees.
That's not just,
that's not what we were intending. So,
seeing no further questions or comments, the chair renews this motion that House File 2525 as amended be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Hansen.
Thank you.
The last bill we have on the agenda for today is Representative Winkler, House File 2313. Representative Winkler, welcome. The chair moves that House File 2313 be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. And it looks like you have an A1 amendment. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair,
would you like to move that amendment? I'll move that amendment. And any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Come on, guys.
Opposed, motion prevails. The bill's in the shape that you want it. Now, Representative Winkler, why don't you go ahead and give a little excitement to this piece of legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will work really hard to give this piece of legislation some excitement. Maybe some of our Republican friends can help with that. Mr. Chair, we have a definition in statute of confidential employee. Confidential for purposes of access to information related to collective bargaining. The courts have interpreted that information or that definition in a way that is, I think, beyond what the legislature originally intended. In the case of AFSCME Council 14 v. Scott, going back to 1995, the court said that a person who has access to confidential information is a confidential employee, even if they don't actually use it, or even if they don't actually have reason to use it, or in any way engage with that data. And I have a testifier here who can talk about a specific instance or example of where that court's definition or interpretation of the language has been used in a way that it is beyond what the legislature intended. So I have Mr. Art McGrain.
Welcome to the committee, and go ahead and identify yourself, please.
Welcome. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Art McGrain. I'm the president of AFSCME Local 668. I'm also a 36-year employee of the Metropolitan Council. I'd like to make it clear I'm not here representing the Met Council in any way. I'm here representing AFSCME. Since 2002, my employer has been using Pelrot to exclude nearly half of our 70 IS staff from union membership. None of the IS staff removed from the union were ever authorized to participate in bargaining strategy on behalf of the employer. Instead, those excluded employees run the network, keep our internet and phones and technology working, and do high-level programming. I've worked on AFSCME's behalf during the unit clarifications that excluded the IS staff from the union. In the most recent unit clarification hearing, the employer stipulated up front all IS staff removed from the union would be subject to discipline if they were to access confidential material without authorization. The union status of employees removed from the union, the union status of employees removed from the union made no difference to the problem itself. Minnesota public employees working in IS safeguard many different kinds of sensitive and non-public information. They could and should do the same with confidential information. Public employers are choosing not to avail themselves of modern security technology. Labor relations files can be password protected. Labor relations files can be stored in secured areas on the network where only authorized people have access. Labor relations files can be accessed using fingerprint technology available on most laptops today. Our agency and other employers, security officers, could set up secure areas for confidential material on the network, but our employers are choosing not to do this. Our public employers are addressing a security problem with a law instead of security technology. And I urge you to close this loophole and reroute public employers back to the original intent of the law.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Green. Is there anybody else in the audience who wishes to testify for or against? Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, go ahead and identify yourself.
I'm Keith Carlson. I'm with the Minnesota Intercounty Association. I'm also speaking on behalf of the Association of Minnesota Counties. Mr. Chairman, I did have distributed to all the committee members a letter on our organization's behalf indicating our opposition to this bill. Representative Winkler did characterize the court's position on this law correctly. There, in fact, have been three separate cases on this, all of which have affirmed the basic tenet that access to labor relations information is sufficient to put these individuals in a separate confidential unit. I do want to make clear to the committee that the inference that these individuals are not allowed to unionize is simply incorrect. Confidential employees have the same right to unionize, have the same right to bargain over all issues that are available to other unions, and several of them do. In other instances, IT employees aren't unionized at all. It depends on from employer to employer. But if you do pass this bill, you would be undermining years of well-settled law. They're not only court decisions affirming this issue. There are numerous Bureau of Mediation Services that really is the venue that decides most of these issues. And basically, the Bureau has decided both for and against employers on this issue, both for and against employees on this issue. Not only would this legislation has proposed affect IT employees, it would also affect other employees of HR departments who have for years been members of confidential units. By eliminating the use of the term access rather than and then putting in its place use or has the amendment is proposed, you are creating, frankly, chaos in the labor relations area by doing this. I do need to point out, well, the issue is Metropolitan Council. Again, this will affect a number of different employers. I urge you not to do this. This legislature has basically carte blanche over the Metropolitan Council. If there is a specific issue with Met Council, then I suggest you call them in, you tell them you've got to resolve this issue, rather than undermining every other public employer in the state's well-settled declassification of employees and the labor relations that exist currently. I'll remind the committee that despite all the promise of technology, each and every one of you knows of numerous times that that technology has been breached. The driver's license database has been breached dozens and dozens and dozens of times by non-IT employees for unauthorized uses. And now they're asking you to believe that IT individuals, exactly the individuals that you asked to come in and fix your computer and automatically bypasses your password by entering the administrator's password, are not going to use this information that they would have access to in many instances, even though it's in their financial interest to do so. That's simply not credible. I urge you to defeat this bill and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. I see Mr. Brinson, you're on the list. You're good to go. Okay, thank you very much. Anybody else wish to testify for or against? Looking not, we'll start with Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Winkler, I was kind of busy yesterday and didn't hear anything about this. This is the first I've seen this or heard of it. So I don't really know which way to go on this, but I'm a little leery of going against the Bureau of Mediation Services. Can you expand on that a little bit and kind of give us why that's a good idea and why we should support your bill and not go with the Bureau?
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hoppe, the issue is that the Minnesota courts have interpreted Minnesota statute in a very specific way, and there's kind of been a tradition or a trend, I guess, in this legal system in Minnesota to use a very kind of strict construction method of interpreting statutes. So they don't look at what the legislature really meant. They typically basically what exactly did the legislature say and base their decision on that. So it's that interpretation of the word access in statute that then informed the subsequent Bureau of Mediation Services decisions since then. So they're basing their decisions on the court's interpretation of our language. And, of course, we always have the ability to clarify and tell the courts, actually, our intent was different from the way you interpreted our words. And so that's where that line of decision is. And the point is, it isn't some principle of labor law that we're talking about here. It's a statutory interpretation question that we just think the courts got wrong.
Thank you.
Very good. Further questions? Representative Benson?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Winkler. So help me understand how we now, as a legislature, are going back into time, channeling the original authors to understand the intent, that it was so much different than how the courts have interpreted it. Bureau of Mediations, how are we suddenly, I mean, this Bentley has been well-settled court law, it would appear at least that this is the first challenge to that interpretation. So help me understand why you think that the authors of the original statute, we got it wrong all these years.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Benson, I think the best clue to that is that the language, before it said access, it used to say that if you worked in the personnel office, you couldn't be a confidential employee. So that informed that meaning. And then as power law was revised over time, they changed the language. And by changing the language, they undermined that idea that people who work in the office that are negotiating the contracts should not be part of the union that is doing the negotiations. The analogy I think used then and makes sense now is the janitor who comes in and clean the offices might have access to that data because they're in the office and the information may be available, but that's not the kind of confidential employee that we are talking about excluding from the bargaining unit. It's in the same way that IT staff, who in theory may have access to it if they use access through the server or through personal laptops or administrative codes, they technically could get to it, but it's not part of their job to deal with that information on a daily basis. And the idea is to address confidentiality for people who have a purpose in using the information, not who could theoretically gain access to it.
Representative Benson?
Well, thank you. Follow up. And Mr. Chair, so it seems, again, we've got another bill before us that essentially what we're trying to do is redefine job classifications, or in this case, confidential to non so that it has the ability to at least to access a greater pool of employees to be a part of the bargaining unit. Am I missing that? Is that really the intent here to say, hey, there's a whole bunch of people that are not being able to be currently organized into the union because of this restriction because of confidentiality of information?
Representative Winkler?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, it isn't simply about that. I assume that Mr. Carlson was correct in his testimony when he said that the confidential employees who are, IT staff who are being treated as or classified as confidential are able to join another bargaining unit in some cases not. So I don't think that it's strictly trying to gain access to a new group of people to organize them and have them join the union. I think the issue is more about whether they should properly be considered confidential and excluded from the main bargaining unit that other employees are part of. It is really a clarification, and I think the Met Council is an example where I think it's being misused, but where we kind of start with a pretty common sense understanding that people who are negotiating the contracts shouldn't be in that same union. On the same and that has changed through a court decision and subsequent use of that court decision by management to exclude a whole group of employees from the bargaining unit.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe we should have changed the agenda to Labor Day. This is a celebration of Labor Day today, but
well, it is the Labor
thank you.
Committee. I mean, I don't know.
Representative Uglum?
It is Labor Committee. thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Winkler, I have one simple question. So how many IT employees and people like in that trade have approached you about this? I see one individual. I see one case with the Met Council. Again, you know, we all represent our constituents, and many of them are employees in IT and so on and so forth. I have not had a single email on this. How many people have been knocking on your door?
Mr. Chair, Representative Uglum, I have not had a cascade of people coming and asking me about this. In fact, if we were basing legislation strictly based on volume of email, I would only work on Sunday liquor sales and DWI immunity for legislators. it's not the only standard we use for judging what's in this, an important issue.
Representative Uglum?
Well, Representative Winkler, that may be true, but it is part of it. Yeah, Sunday liquor sales, whole nother story. Thank you.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the record, I think Representative Winkler is working diligently on some of those other issues that he is outlined here for us this morning. Representative Winkler, just kind of following up what Representative Uglum had said, I hear the Met Council. Is this a situation where taking a meat cleaver or a surgical instrument would be better used in this to clarify? Going back to Mr. Carlson's testimony, why isn't there something we could do for clarification for the Met Council, since it is a hybrid type of legislative created? Yes, it's a political subdivision, but it covers multi-jurisdictions. It seems to me that we could have some precedent because of what the Met Council is, that we could put some special language in to help these individuals without branching out into other areas where it's maybe not a problem.
Representative Winkler?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, I could be wrong, but I would tend to think it would not be a great idea to carve out special rules in PELRA based on the type of local jurisdiction we're talking about. And just because this example comes from the Met Council doesn't mean that this is the only place it occurs or where it could occur around the state. And the idea is we see this as an example of the court interpreting our language one way, the management negotiating and defining employees in a different way, and it kind of gets us pretty far from where we were originally, and it's just a corrective. And I think if we solve the problem, we'd before long be back here dealing with it for other jurisdictions as well.
Representative Driscoll.
And by the way, I'm not saying it doesn't happen anywhere else. I'm just saying this is the example I'm familiar with.
Go ahead, Representative Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Winkler, along that same line, because that's kind of where I was going, is I think you had cited three grievances or cases on this where there's been issues. I think I recall you saying ask me 14 or if I maybe to have the number wrong v. Scott on that. Is that Scott County or is that an individual? And maybe you can give us a little background of where those cases have come from. Are they just the Met Council or are they other jurisdictions, just again for the committee's benefit?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, the case I mentioned was ask me Council 14 v. County of Scott from 1995. There's another case here, which is AFSCME Council 14 v. City of Plymouth. And those are appeals, I think, both of them from the Bureau of Mediation Services interpretation, and then those decisions were overturned, at least in the Scott case, I think, that was overturned by the court based on their interpretation of the language in PELRA. So this is an issue where the interpretation and use of confidential employee is a statewide issue. The specific case of IT staff being classified as confidential employees is coming from the Met Council. I'm guessing that that probably happens other places as well, but I don't have information about it.
Representative O'Driscoll?
Representative Winkler and I may have worked together too long because he's anticipated sort of the next question I was going to in his response, and that is, what were the grievances from what positions in the Scott County, AFSCME 14B, Scott County, and AFSCME 14B, Plymouth?
Representative Winkler?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, I have admit that I have not reviewed the factual background of those cases. I've mostly just looked at the court's analysis, but it looks like... Well, it doesn't have much in it, actually. In the City of Plymouth case, the facts and the... it was IT staff in the Scott County case. At least they, I assume it is Information Systems and Services Department. Sounds like IT staff to me.
Representative Driscoll?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what was the AFSCME Council 14 v. Plymouth date of that? You had said that the AFSCME Council 14 v. Scott County was... circa 1995, if I'm not mistaken.
Mr. Chair, Representative Driscoll, it was 1997. And I think Mr. Carlson referenced a third court decision on this, too. I'm not sure what that is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in a period of about 20 years, we've had three cases that seem to have been gone to the Board of the Bureau of Mediation and have been appealed to district court. In your opinion, Representative Winkler, is that an excessive amount of use of the court time in that 20 period of time, and how might that deal with other kinds of labor-related matters that may or may not find themselves being needed to be adjudicated in the court because of disputes?
No, Winkler, comments?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, I think the point is that the court has spoken clearly about its interpretation of statute, and the Bureau of Mediation Services is simply applying the court's ruling. So the fact that there isn't more litigation doesn't mean the issue doesn't come up. It just means the Bureau of Mediation Services is dealing with it in a way that is settled under the court's law. And, of course, we always have the ability to clarify or to correct the court's decision, which is really, I mean, just to, on the record, the intention is to change the court's ruling in that original AFSCME v. Scott case and go back to what I think is the proper intention of the legislature.
Very good. Any summary closing comments then, Representative Winkler?
I think we covered it, Mr.
Chair.
I think
you nailed it. Thank you very much. The chair renews this motion that House File 2313, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Government Operations. All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Uglum?
Like a roll call on this.
Roll call being requested. We will have one. Being referred to the Committee on GovOps and a roll call being requested, the chair will take, or the clerk will take the roll.
Johnson.
Johnson votes yes.
O'Driscoll?
No.
Benson?
No.
Fisher?
Yes.
Hoppy?
No.
Kiefer?
No.
Lane?
Yes.
Mason?
Yes.
Metza? Nelson?
Yes.
O'Neill?
No.
Savick?
Yes.
Simonson?
Yes.
Sundin?
Yes.
Uglum?
Nope.
8-6.
The vote being 8-6, the motion prevails. The bill is re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. Thank you, Representative Winkler, for your time. I'd like to make some closing comments for people leave. This is our last hearing, God willing, for 2014. I'd like to thank Anita for all her work over here, Ms. Newman, Bob Elup, who's not here right now, but Mr. Oliver, our research, and Mr. Rubis over here, Laura for clerking. Thank you very much. And last, I'd like to thank Representative Benson for your time on the committee. I know you're moving on, I do believe. And Representative Kiefer, thank you for your service. And thank you for collegiality, Representative O'Driscoll, and making the committee work reasonably well, I think. So,
Mr. Chair, and I would like to also thank nonpartisan staff as well as partisan staff. These can be issues that come before this committee where there are diverging opinions, and I appreciate your willingness to let this be vetted out on both sides and get a good hearing for the people in the state of Minnesota. So I appreciate that as the lead on the minority side on behalf of our caucus. Thank you so much.
Very good. And good luck to all of us, I guess, right? With that, the meeting is adjourned.